Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Today is for the birds.
They don't do well in deep snowpacks. They don't do well without food year-round to forage. They're actually very well adapted to urban spaces.
We'll talk wild turkeys in Boston streets and some turkey food alternatives.
You cannot make wheat gluten taste like a turkey. That's not what I went for.
And what about some of the other birds you might see? Birding legend David Sibley shares his excitement.
You're left with this feeling of, what else is out there? What's going to be in the next bush? What's going to show up tomorrow?
Plus, brown bird musician Morgan Eve Swain on love, loss, and inner strength.
It's this mythical point where heaven and earth connect, and it opens up communication between higher and lower realms.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
For this Thanksgiving Day 2016, this is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I say it every year. This is my favorite holiday because I like the idea of stepping out of the jet stream of modern life and taking a moment to feel and share gratitude. So, happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We're grateful that you're spending the next hour with us. Today, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to celebrate not just turkey, but all birds, and listen back to some of our favorite avian-themed conversations. And for you birders out there, we'll start with a little pop quiz for you. Do you recognize this? That's the Magnolia warbler, which you might have seen here in New England, although it spends its winters in the Caribbean. The gray and yellow bird was a major influence on revered bird documentarian David Allen Sibley. He's writer and illustrator of The Sibley Guide to Birds. He's so loved, in fact, that his very name has been turned into a noun in the field, as in, is that a rhinoceros auklet? I don't know. Did you bring your Sibley? Well, we spoke with David Allen Sibley back in May 2014 upon the release of the second edition of The Sibley Guide.
I started birding as a young kid, and my father's an ornithologist. I'm sure that had something to do with my early interest in birds. But when I was in third grade, he was working at Point Reyes Bird Observatory in California. And I came home from school one day, and he was at home with some other people from the bird observatory, and that was unusual for him to be home in the middle of the afternoon, and they had brought to the house this rare bird that had been trapped at the bird observatory, where the birds are trapped and banded. They're they're marked with a numbered tag on their leg and then released. But this one they brought to the house because it was a spring-plumaged male magnolia warbler, the first one that had ever been trapped and banded there, and one of very few records in the state of California at that time.
Oh, wow.
I was only in third grade, but I had been birding for a year and knew the picture from the book, and I knew that it was incredibly rare, and just to see it right there in our house, to hold it in my hand, was just an incredible experience.
I mean, was it like a, they're small, right? So I can imagine there was this trembling little creature in your hands when you were, what, nine,
yeah,
eight, seven, eight?
Eight years old. Yeah, they're very small, like 8 grams, a third of an ounce.
Huh.
Just incredibly full of life. If you, I'm sure some of the people listening have had a chance to hold a bird. One of the things you notice is how light they are, but how full of energy.
Yeah.
And this one was on top of all that, just like a little feathered jewel of yellow and black and gray and white. And then we let it go. It flew off into the woods, and it, of course, disappeared. Nobody ever saw it again. Which is the way birds go, but it's sort of, you're left with this feeling of, what else is out there? What's going to be in the next bush? What's going to show up tomorrow?
Is that what you really love about birding, that it's very transient. It's very in the moment. The birds are there when they want to be, and then they're gone.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's a huge part of it. And especially right now, this time of year, the birds are migrating. There's this huge global movement of birds, billions of birds moving north right now. And you could wake up in Massachusetts, and if you're listening or watching the birds in your yard, tomorrow morning there could be 10 species that weren't there today. They just appear overnight.
Wow.
That, and it's just that no matter how good you get at identifying birds, you still have no control over where the birds are going. You just go out and see what's there, and you never know what you're going to find.
Well, listeners, I'm speaking with David Allen Sibley. The second edition of the Sibley Guide to Birds is now out. It's got hundreds of new illustrations on it. We're going to talk about the art in the guide in a second, including some ultra-rare species in North America. So I'm guessing that a lot of listeners out there have at least the first edition. And if you've got a question for David Allen Sibley, if you're a birder and you love those magical moments when the birds appear and then they disappear, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm curious if you take your Sibley with you out into the field and what it is you love about birding in particular. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also, I'm about to say this, send us a tweet at Radio Boston. It may be the most appropriate use of the term ever. So, David, tell us, you told us about the Magnolia Warbler, one of your spark birds, so to speak. But I'm wondering about why and how you ended up being an illustrator and such a close observer of birds that the first edition of the Sibley Guide came into being.
Well, I started with an interest in birds very young, but also an interest in drawing. And for me, the two things have always gone together, and the drawing is it's always been scientific illustration. It's about information, and it's a way of studying birds, a way of learning about them, so that I use the drawing as a way to work through all of the aspects of what a bird looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I learn by drawing and by studying the birds in order to draw them. So that, it all goes together for me. Bird watching and drawing are parts of the same thing, and it just, the more I learned, the more I wanted to put it all together into a compilation like a book.
Yeah, and I have a couple questions about the mechanics of how you do your illustrations, because, you know, I imagine you sitting out in the field with your telescope and your binoculars. You kind of have to wait for your subjects to appear when they want to. And even though individual species absolutely have characteristic shape and coloring, et cetera, there have to be the variations within the actual individual birds that you're looking at in the same species. So how do you decide sort of how to actually put it all together into what's going to be your final illustration?
Yeah, that's one of the big challenges, is trying to pick the average, this sort of typical individual of each species or each plumage. I spend a tremendous amount of time in the field just watching, and watching birds, looking at shapes and posture, and I might spend 20 minutes watching for every minute that I spend actually putting pencil on paper.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot of looking and watching and sort of summarizing in my mind or trying to learn what the average shape is and then finally putting that on paper.
Why do you think, for the purposes of a birding guide, that illustrations, or do you think illustrations, are superior to photographs?
I do think they're...
I mean, I'm asking a master illustrator. I understand, but I'm curious why you think that.
Yeah, after all the years of painting, it would be hard for me to answer any differently. But I think that the advantages that illustrations have over photographs are, first, that it allows me as the illustrator to be in complete control of what I show, the posture, the plumage, the shape, the lighting, so I can make the illustrations comparable in a way that only an illustration can be.
Hmm.
But it also, it allows me to simplify the images, to take out a lot of the details and strip away all the background. It removes any suggestion of a story or an experience from the field guide, so that No matter what you've seen in the field, whether you've seen the bird in snow or fog or bright sun, in a forest or in a field or on a beach, it will still match the illustration in the field guide.
Right. A cardinal is a cardinal is a cardinal, regardless of if it's snow or springtime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a photograph tells you a story of a moment in time that might not match what you've just seen yourself.
Now, there are thousands of birds in the guide here, 600 new paintings, and 111 rare species have been added. I know you haven't seen absolutely all of them that are in the guide, but you've seen most of them?
Most of them, yes. I haven't counted. In the first edition, there were 8 species that I had never seen, and in the 14 years since then, I've seen 5 of those 8. Now, I added a bunch of new rare species to the second edition, so I haven't counted, but I'm guessing it's now 15 or 20 species in the book that I've never seen.
Okay, well, we've actually got some tape of one of those, which I think you still haven't seen yet. And the tape, I should say, comes from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, where you once worked many moons ago. Fantastic resource for anyone who loves animals, and especially birds. They've got phenomenal recordings there that are all available online. But let's listen to the call of this particular bird. So a fantastic sound. That's the Gunnison sage grouse?
It is, yeah.
And you've never seen it?
I actually saw it for the first time just a month and a half ago
Colorado,
yes.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's a rare one.
It's only found in a small area in southwestern Colorado in the Gunnison Valley, and there are only about 4,000 of them in total.
In North America or in the world?
In the world. That's the only place they're found, and total population is under 5,000.
So that must have been quite a thrill.
It was, yeah. It was great. And that's just the way they sound. But to hear that, you have to get up at 3:30 in the morning, drive out to the area where the males are going to display, and get yourself into position and wait for sunrise. And then they start to show up. Before first light, the males will come out onto this display ground and gather, and they start making that sound while it's just barely light enough to see them.
Wow.
And it gradually gets lighter and more birds show up, and it's just a really fantastic place.
Well, David, we've got a lot of birders on the line who want to talk to you. Listeners, I'm speaking with David Allen Sibley. He is one of the legends in the world of birding. He lives in Concord. He's with us now talking about the new second edition of the Sibley Guide to Birds. So let's start hearing from our callers. Lee is calling from Reading. You're on the air, Lee.
Yeah, hi. My question is about the dawn chorus. I was raised in northern Westchester County over 40 years ago as a kid. I remember the tremendous racket of birds bursting into song at the crack of dawn. Mm-hmm. Now I'm a mom in north of suburban Boston, and I'm wondering, is there any place where I can bring my kids to hear something like that? At the crack of dawn, yeah, I hear birds, but nothing like I remembered, and I know the songbird populations have pretty much crashed. I know it's something like, 70-80% down, but I would just love my kids to be able to hear that, and I don't know where I could even find it if it's something that still exists, you know, not too far away from where we live.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for your call. David?
It happens this time of year. It happens at about between 4:30 and 5:30 in the morning when it's just getting light. That's when the birds really, really tune up. And I think if you get out to a park with a good patch of woods, where there would be a lot of nesting birds, and it's species like rose-breasted grosbeak, scarlet tanager, red-eyed vireo, and the several species of warblers that nest in this area, those will be a big part of the dawn chorus. In your yard, you probably have robins and cardinals and chickadees and tufted titmouse, things like that. They'll also be a big part of any woodland area chorus. But if you can get to a park or a big patch of 100 acres or more of forest, you'll probably hear a pretty good dawn chorus.
Well, David, I want to play the sound or the song of another bird, because Lee had mentioned about the crash in the songbird populations worldwide, including North America. This is the call of the wood thrush, which has declined more than 40%, I believe, since the 1960s. It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, is that part of why birding, you find birding so important? Because not only you're observing the birds, but you're learning about the environment that the birds are sort of representative of.
Yeah, it automatically makes connections. You find certain species in certain habitats that leads to an understanding of the importance of different habitats, the importance of diversity, what the birds are eating, what they build their nests out of. All those things are really key to their survival. And bird watchers are obviously going to be some of the first ones to notice if a species is declining in an area. They just get harder to find.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I keep looking at all these people who do want to talk to you on our call list, and I want to see if we can sneak a couple more of them in. Craig is calling from Florence. You're on the air, Craig.
Wow, I can't believe I feel like I'm talking to the god of birds. My God, this is like talking to Charles Darwin. I'm out in Florence, Mass., and I feed the birds out here. I'm also a sculler, so I get to see, like, the bald eagles, and there's a rookery for blue herons around here, which I won't name. But I'm wondering, I always try to feed these birds suet because I get a lot of beautiful woodpeckers. Even pileated's come out here to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when do you stop feeding suet because it gets to be such a mess and I think it gets rancid and stuff. I'm just wondering, as a feeder, when I should stop that.
Yeah, as far as the general question of whether it's okay to feed birds year-round, it is. It's not like you're offering them junk food or making them lazy or reliant on bird feeders. It's okay to feed them year-round. But suet is sort of a special case that it doesn't last very long in the hot weather of spring and summer. So I would say probably when if the outdoors is warmer than a refrigerator, it might be time to stop feeding suet. You could probably still put small bits out in the summer if they're going to be eaten up quickly, and the woodpeckers would enjoy that. But yeah, you don't want it to make a mess or get rancid.
We've got a tweet here from Ricky L. Jones, who sent us a message saying, "Mr. Sibley, are there still lifers, parentheses, birds, out there that you're still trying to find, or have you seen them all?"
There's still some, yes. And, well, in North America, in the world, of course, there are thousands that I've never seen. But the Gunnison sage grouse was the last North American breeding species that I hadn't seen. So the ones that are left are the species that are rare visitors to North America, like Aztec thrush that comes from Mexico. And just almost every year, some show up in Arizona, just north of the border. Or Murphy's petrel, which nests in the South Pacific and shows up off California pretty regularly. But you have to be on a boat 100 miles offshore and get lucky.
In the last, 5 seconds we have, I'm just curious, why are all the birds facing right in the book?
That is to make them easier to compare.
Okay.
So that they all match, and it's just easy to glance across the pages and see what the similarities and differences are.
Wow. Well, the illustrations are absolutely beautiful, and the information is wonderful. So thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That's David Allen Sibley. We spoke with him in May 2014 as the second edition of the Sibley Guide to Birds was released. When we come back, some new twists on the traditional Thanksgiving dinner.
We fry a turkey. It's a hell of a lot of fun.
Don't do it on your wooden deck.
Exactly.
Don't do it in your kitchen.
My father did it in his garage with all my uncles smoking cigars.
Okay. Oh, good.
It turned out great. Yeah.
Nice way to bring family dysfunction under one roof. Yeah, that sounds great.
And let's close this segment with one of the most haunting bird calls you'll hear, the wail of a pair of common loons. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Thanksgiving, of course, and since we're dedicating this special hour of Radio Boston to birds, we thought we'd pay our respects to the great turkey, specifically the wild turkey, which thrives all across New England, including in our cities. Now, those urban birds strut their stuff as if they own the streets, but Yoni Applebaum says the fact that they're even here at all is the result of careful conservation efforts. Applebaum is a senior editor for The Atlantic magazine. And last November, Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks spoke with Applebaum about the slow decline and eventual return of wild turkeys in the Northeast. The story begins in 1620, as Plymouth Colony Governor William Bradford looked out onto Massachusetts from the Mayflower.
He saw what he called a hideous and desolate wilderness full of wild beasts. It was both a little bit terrifying to the pilgrims, but also this vast bounty, game, deer, turkeys, geese, a rich and abundant array of wildlife that they could harvest to make it through the hard winters.
And you point out that the wildlife population was actually pretty carefully tended by the Native Americans, right?
Well, yes, indirectly. They set brush fires to clear out the undergrowth of the forests, to make them productive landscapes, to encourage the growth of nut-bearing trees. And there may have been something else going on, too. Not long before the pilgrims got to the New World, there was a plague of a European-introduced pathogen, probably hepatitis, which had devastated the land around Plymouth where they settled. And so it seems likely that the wildlife population of Plymouth had actually exploded in those years without being hunted quite as aggressively as it otherwise would have been.
Mm. But you say, speaking of aggressive hunting, that the pilgrims essentially took too many turkeys and pretty much began a path toward extinction.
Yeah, it didn't take long. So by the end of the 17th century, turkeys have essentially vanished from much of eastern Massachusetts. By the middle of the 19th century, the last bird that we can document is taken from western Massachusetts. And then they retreat to smaller populations. Estimates vary, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of birds, but not the perhaps tens of millions that existed in North America before the arrival of European colonists.
Yeah. So tell us about this great sort of conservation effort or sort of parallel efforts, really, that helped bring these birds back from extinction.
Well, gamesmen were trying to bring them back for a good part of the 20th century. At first, capturing small turkeys or eggs, trying to rear them and then reintroduce them into the wild. Notably, those efforts lacked success. Then they tried rocket-fired nets to capture the wild birds, and that proved more successful. And they were able to trap and release 37 turkeys from upstate New York back into western Massachusetts in the early 1970s.
You also, and this I found really interesting, that you talk about the return of nature to populated living spaces, starting with squirrels. And it starts in cities that include Boston, right?
Yeah, when Boston put squirrels back onto Boston Common, crowds of hundreds gather to see them. The city council has to appropriate funds to feed the squirrels because, of course, they can't imagine that squirrels are going to find food in an urban place. And in fact, the squirrels don't. They die out. But this is part of a slow reintroduction of wildlife into urban spaces. When Bradford and the pilgrims looked out, they saw a sharp line between civilization and wilderness. They couldn't understand that the landscape they were looking at was actually tended and productive, and that people were living side by side with these animals. Slowly, what we've seen over the last century as New England has reforested, as these populations have reestablished themselves first in rural areas, they've then migrated back in to suburbia and then into urban areas, discovering that these can be very effective habitats. In fact, in many ways, more hospitable habitats than the forests where the conservationists initially reintroduced them.
See, it's really interesting. In fact, your piece is titled Why Wild Turkeys Hate the Wild. So why did they hate the wild and find themselves sort of better accommodated, in suburban Brookline, for example?
Well, there's a little head writer's license in that. There are certainly lots of wild turkeys out there in the wild. But what we do know is that the birds that learn to scavenge on farms survive hard winters a lot more effectively than the ones which are actually out there in the forest, which more closely resemble their original habitat. And as they moved into suburban and urban areas, they've also thrived. They don't do well in deep snowpacks. They don't do well without food year-round to forage. They're actually very well adapted to urban spaces. They aren't always well adapted to people. And in Brookline and other suburbs around Boston, there's now a considerable tension between the local residents and the turkeys. We might bear in mind that the turkeys were here a lot longer than we've been here.
Yeah, and I love it when you write, the contemporary city might as well have been designed for turkeys. And by that you mean, I mean, you sort of just explained that, but I guess one of the things that's well designed for them is scraps of food left behind by people like us make for a pretty comfortable environment for them, right?
Lots of food. They shovel the snow out of the way. There's lots of grass these days in cities. What's remarkable to me is that I still sort of take a step back every time I see a turkey and rub my eyes. For my kids, they're just very large pigeons. They're a constant feature of the urban environment, one that's been there their entire lifespans. Very much like squirrels were this exotic wildlife that seemed jarringly out of place in an urban environment. For our children and our grandchildren, turkeys are going to become just an ordinary part of urban existence.
And finally, what about the future of the wild turkey? I mean, are these populations going to continue to adapt and thrive in cities? I mean, I would imagine that we could reach a point when there could be too many wild turkeys roaming around the city.
Well, I know a lot of people who already think that there are. The Department of Conservation and Recreation, one recent estimate, guessed that there were about 18,000 turkeys in Massachusetts. I suspect that number, which has grown very rapidly in the few decades since their reintroduction, will continue to expand, and the turkeys will become an ever more ubiquitous part of life in Massachusetts.
That's Yoni Applebaum, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, speaking with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks last November. You can find a link to Applebaum's Atlantic article, Why Wild Turkeys Hate the Wild, at radioboston.org. Well, as much as we may love or even hate to see wild turkeys roaming urban streets, most Americans' closest interaction with the turkey is from store to oven to table on Thanksgiving. But there are increasing numbers of people who don't center their Thanksgiving celebrations around the bird, or they've got different takes on traditional turkey with cranberry sauce, stuffing, and mashed potatoes. Anthony Brooks sat down with an all-star team of Boston foodies to talk about these alternative Thanksgiving meals. He spoke with Amy Traverso, senior lifestyle editor at Yankee Magazine, and with chef Michael Leviton, and with Brian Van Etten, who at the time was the head chef at the Cambridge vegetarian eatery Veggie Galaxy. He's now a chef at Root Catering in Rochester, New York.
So, Amy, let me start with you with sort of an overview. You've brought something delicious here, which we're going to taste. But before we talk about that, tell us about some of the less traditional techniques for preparing turkey, which are gaining popularity.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people now are very familiar with the idea of brining a turkey. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to ensure that the breast meat, which cooks more quickly, remains moist while you're waiting for those thighs to cook. And that's the problem with turkey, is it's a big bird and it's not that easy
to
cook.
It cooks unevenly.
Unevenly, right.
Yeah.
So brining keeps that moisture in, and it also just adds flavor. However, the one downside to brining is sometimes the breast meat can get a little bit spongy. Mm. Nothing bad, but just a tiny bit spongy. So there's this alternate method, which is called dry brining or dry curing, where you put the salt and spices directly on the skin of the bird and let that sit for a few days, 2 or 3 days.
So it's refrigerated, of course.
Refrigerated, yeah. Not out on the counter. If it's consistently cold, you could rig up a cooler outside, maybe mm-hmm. packed with some ice. But you do it in the fridge. It's the easiest way if you have the room. You let it sit, and you get the advantage of brining without that spongy texture.
So is this what you've brought
That's
here?
What
because
I brought
it
in.
Smells amazing. So here's what I'm going to suggest. Do you want to cut off a piece so that we can taste it? And in the meantime, I'll move on to Michael Leviton. For those of us who want to maintain the tradition but who want something other than a frozen supermarket bird, you're a fan of something called heritage turkeys, right?
Yes.
How does a heritage turkey compare to the sort of standard turkey that you're going to get at the standard supermarket?
It's gamier. The breast meat, although white, it has a distinctly richer, deeper, more wild flavor.
So are these the turkeys, for instance, I spend time in southern New Hampshire, and every now and then a turkey will go charging across the field. That's the traditional American wild turkey.
Yeah, they're much closer to the ones that are in my neighborhood in Lexington than are the broad-breasted white Purdue factory farm bird. And these are really birds that spend their entire lives, you know, from the time they're 8 weeks old, they are outside eating the right food and, you know, raising these animals the right way and having the right genetics. Really, these birds, they taste so much deeper and richer than our traditional dry turkey.
And my guess is that you're going to pay a little more for these.
Significantly more.
Significantly more. But worth it in your view?
Absolutely.
All right. Amy, in the meantime, you've sliced some of this dry cured turkey, which looks beautiful, and it's filled this studio with a great aroma, so I'm going to try it.
Amy, May I try some? Oh. I'm not vegetarian.
Oh, you're not? No. Oh, I'm sorry. I
assumed as much. Now, listeners, just so you know, Amy left Brian Van Etten. Now, assuming he was a vegetarian, but we're going to give him some turkey, too.
Thank you.
Amy, it's great. It's really, really good. So it's got a nice, salty flavor to it.
It has a mixture of herbs. There's rosemary, thyme, sage, mustard seed, and salt and pepper.
Well, it's delicious. And listeners, we're going to put all these recipes and ideas on our website at radioboston.org. So you'll get all that information there. Brian, let me come over to you because Thanksgiving shouldn't be a holiday that vegetarians dread or are excluded from. So you're head chef of the popular vegetarian restaurant Veggie Galaxy in Cambridge. You've brought in something that looks amazing. Tell us what you've done here.
Well, first and foremost, I think that the vegetarian community, although they're not consuming turkey, they still like to have something at the forefront of their meal.
Absolutely.
It's very popular. People are buying this frozen tofurkey, which is basically a soy and wheat gluten loaf that's stuffed with some breading. But what I've done is basically take my own riff off of that. So at the restaurant, we make seitan, which is basically rinsed wheat until all you have is the glutinous part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's made into a dough with a lot of spices. We have a lot of toasted fennel seed in here. There is some toasted allspice. And after you make a dough, you gently cook it. And then we've rolled it, and inside we've rolled it with a bunch of roasted shiitake mushrooms. We've added some golden raisins that we plumped in a little white wine and a touch of cinnamon. And after we've rolled it up, we re-cook it so it adheres together. It looks like a roulade, some would say. And then finally, this morning, I just braised it very gently with a little dark beer and a little apple cider.
Oh, wow. It looks so beautiful. So why don't you slice some pieces off
Absolutely.
Here? And in the meantime, I'd love to ask you, while you're doing that,
yes.
What's the sort of key to successful cooking with, how do I say this, with faux meat products like seitan, for example?
The key is try to imitate less. From my perspective, vegetarian food doesn't have to be a straight imitation. It just has to be good, and it has to somehow slightly replace what's missing on the meals. You know, you cannot make wheat gluten taste like a turkey. And so that's not what I went for here. I went to make wheat gluten, which is high in protein, which is what a lot of vegetarians are looking for. And I went to just make that flavorful and good.
Well, I look forward to tasting that. And while you're cutting that, Brian, Michael, let me come back to you. And for the purists out there who want to roast their turkeys, whether it's a heritage turkey or traditional turkey, for those of us unaccustomed to roasting a turkey, what are the most important pointers we need to be aware of?
I think that, as Amy pointed out before, there's the traditional problem of the breast cooking before the legs. And there are a couple of different ways around this, depending on whether you've stuffed your bird or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't stuffed your bird, I like to blast it in a 500-degree oven until it begins to brown up nicely, but then drop the oven temperature to about 250 degrees and cook it very, very slowly.
Nice.
And that helps to cook everything a little more evenly without drying it out.
Mm.
With a stuffed bird, you have to go a slightly higher temperature because you don't want the stuffing in there to be in contact with the raw meat for too long.
And what do you like? I mean, do you prefer cooking a stuffed bird, or is there an advantage?
I actually fry my turkey.
You see, this is what I wanted to ask.
Okay,
the next question.
Okay, so we fry a turkey. Glad you asked.
Yeah. I've done that a couple of times with some success. It's pretty exciting.
It's very exciting.
I think
it's
I did a 16-pound turkey in something like 45 minutes, which is
yes, it's
incredible.
Just about 3 minutes a pound.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, get your inner redneck on for a day or so.
Don't do it on your wooden deck.
Exactly.
Don't do it in your kitchen, right?
It was actually raining one time when I did it, and I stood out there with the umbrella for 45 minutes. I wouldn't recommend it doing it in the rain either.
Right. My father did it in his garage with all my uncles smoking cigars.
Okay. Oh, good.
It turned out great.
Yeah.
Nice way to bring family dysfunction under one roof. Yeah, that sounds great. Which is what Thanksgiving's all about,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
Sorry, Michael.
No. I was going to say something inappropriate, so it's probably good that you. But it really, to me, I mean, you get a fabulous tasting bird.
Yeah.
You get wonderful crispiness. It stays really moist, provided you also don't overcook it. I think one of the things that's really helpful is to have a thermopen, instant read thermometer. The value of this cannot be underestimated. Yeah. It's a fabulous tool.
But here's my question. What do you do about the stuffing? Because, of course, you can't fry it stuffed, right?
There's the problem with that. So the last time we did Thanksgiving at home, I fried one and then roasted another one with the stuffing. Because to me, one of the best parts of Thanksgiving is the stuffing that comes from that one particular area just at the opening of the cavity of the bird, mm-hmm. where you get both that interplay of crisp, slightly dried out stuffing, and where it's also absorbed all of the great juice from the turkey.
Mm. Now, I got a couple more questions, but Brian has sliced up this turkey made from wheat protein, so I want to give it a shot.
Oh, that's really cool.
This is amazing. The seitan, it has the texture of meat. And this has delicious flavor, by the way.
However you treat it, you can have it contain all sorts of different textures. Yeah. At the restaurant, we make huge logs of it, shave it, and it has the texture and shape and look of deli meat. Hmm. The same token, we'll make smaller logs, cook it a little bit less, cut it into patties, and we call it chorizo patties. It's like little sausage patties fried up on the grill. You can really modify this product any way you want.
Amy, I'm curious to come back to you. Why do you think more and more people are choosing to break with this sort of tradition? Or are they? Is that what you're observing out there?
I think people are actually more traditional with Thanksgiving than maybe any other meal of the year. I think there are certain dishes that just are emotionally salient for them that you just wouldn't feel like Thanksgiving without them. But what they are doing is playing with the seasonings. And and I think that's a great approach. Keep your turkey, keep the stuffing, you know, just vary it slightly. But, you know, and then you always have to have Aunt Helen's green bean casserole. And that's fine. Have that because it's something we look forward to every year. In the November issue of Yankee, we have a great recipe for sweet potatoes that are cooked in a chai spiced glaze. And it's familiar, but it's a little bit of a twist. And I think that's what people are looking for.
So something that I've noticed about family traditions, we've certainly held on to some that everyone seems to like. But after the longest time, we realized that we were holding on to traditions that nobody liked. For example, everyone thought that we had to have creamed onions because creamed onions were always a part of Thanksgiving. And then one day, you know, I think it was sort of August or September, we were having a conversation with my mother and it was like, but no one likes them. Do you like them? No, I make them because I thought you liked them. Well, I was eating them because I thought you liked them. It turned out that nobody liked creamed onions. So they were finally banished after about 40 years of Thanksgiving tradition in our house.
Yeah, I think it's good to have every new generation. Then when the next generation steps up, you have a family meeting and you figure out what you're keeping and what you're getting rid of.
All right. Let me whip around the table for one final question and just ask you all what your favorite Thanksgiving meal tradition is that might be a little out of the ordinary. Michael, let me put you on the spot first.
I don't know. For me, it's now the fried turkey. That's become a tradition.
Yeah.
And even though we're going to somebody else's house these days, we still set up the turkey fryer and do an extra bird.
I think it's a great idea. How about you, Amy?
In my family, my grandmother always made this sort of a squash souffle that was served with the turkey, but it really was essentially pumpkin pie filling baked in a souffle dish. So for us as kids, it was a great way to get dessert before dessert was served. And so I continue to make that dish, and it's a big crowd pleaser.
Brian?
A more general tradition, my family has recently turned towards having kind of like a cooking competition for Thanksgiving where everyone, to relieve the stress of one person doing the whole meal, everyone brings something, and we actually have a trophy we pass around to that year's winner based on who had the best dish.
Oh, that's a great idea. So who won last year?
Last year I won.
You won. And what was it?
It was a very straightforward, simply roasted Brussels sprouts, a little chorizo in there, some red pepper chili flake, and some garlic and shallot.
Oh, that sounds great.
That's my colleague Anthony Brooks speaking with Brian Van Etten, a chef at Root Catering in Rochester, New York, and with Amy Traverso, senior lifestyle editor at Yankee Magazine, and chef Michael Leviton. You can find recipes for Brian's roasted Brussels sprouts with goodies, Amy's dry cured turkey, and Michael's fried turkey at our website, radioboston.org. Well, when we come back, love, loss, and moving forward with one half of the musical duo Brown Bird.
It's this mythical point where heaven and earth connect. Reading about this phrase was like a bolt of lightning hit me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
She's the dying heart of this ragged old town.
We're spending this hour listening back to some of our favorite bird-themed conversation. This final one is more metaphorical than literally avian. Back in 2011, we talked with the Rhode Island duo Brown Bird, Dave Lamb with that wine-dark voice, and his mistress of strings, Morgan Eve Swain.
Don't you hear the sound of ghosts come from the grave? Don't you do it like we've done when we had our way? There ain't no night, no hunting here, I'm gonna save the day. So get off the floor, be on before you wither away.
At the time, Brown Bird had just taken the Newport Folk Festival by storm. Lamb and Swain got married and fast became a fixture in a growing group of musically restless, lyrically honest songwriters.
You know, I know when we sit down to write a song and work on music, we don't necessarily think about that at all. If we're involved in the spirit of that time period and this creative movement that's happening, that's great. You know, we feel, you know, we're glad to be a part of that.
There's definitely a community, though, that we're part of that I think is great.
It was a heady few years, followed by unexpected news. Dave Lamb was diagnosed with leukemia, and he died in April 2014. Despite his illness, though, Lamb and Swain had been at work on a new album, and despite losing her partner in music and in life, Morgan Eve Swain decided to finish the record. It's called Axis Mundi. Swain spoke with us about the album last year, and we started with the song she says she's most proud of. This is Bannermen.
This one we wrote before Dave became ill, and this was kind of the point we were like, yep, definitely going electric, definitely going to play electric bass. You know, we've been listening to, you know, a lot of psych rock from the Middle East from the 60s and 70s. We're listening to, you know, a lot of John Zorn, stuff like that, and we're really into these crazy rhythms. And this was the first time that we really kind of went for it, and I think nailed it.
Love, relations, alibi, cascading down tonight on 207 souls, the bleeding and the bold enemies abound, and battle cries resound and beckon them to war, a willful fight forevermore.
I mean, you can really hear it. It's got like such a gritty swing to it.
Yeah.
It's the one I've been listening to over and over.
Excellent.
Well, what was your hope overall for the album as a whole when you sort of began the project?
Well, began the project meaning meaning when exactly?
Yeah, good question. I mean, when do you think the beginning of the project was?
Fair question. Some of these songs were written before Dave became diagnosed, and there was a real effort to make them more rock-inspired and heavier, and, you know, we were having a lot of fun with the writing process. You know, Bannermen is one of those songs, and as things progressed, you know, Dave was writing through his illness, and it was very therapeutic for him. It's an interesting record in that respect because it was written through this, you know, horrific experience, and he recorded all these demos at home. And so the second half of the project was me completing the record after he had passed, you know, taking all of his demos, which were beautifully recorded by himself in our home with GarageBand, and I re-recorded all my parts and completed everything. And so it's kind of a two-part project that I'm very proud of.
Did the meaning change when it became clear that, you know, he was very ill again?
I'm not sure if it changed for him. You know, it's one of those things where you listen back now and a lot of the lyrics are, you know, is there meaning here? Or am I reading into this? Like, did he know something that I didn't know? And there's a lot of that that I'm sure other people are hearing now too. For me, one of the things I keep telling people is that our intention with this record was, you know, to come back with a bang. And when he was better, we were going to be touring and we were going to have a drummer with us, and it was going to be like, we're back and we're bigger and better than ever.
A victory album.
Yeah, a victory album. It's obviously not what we intended, but to me it's still a victory record.
Should we listen to a little bit more?
Sure.
This is again from the new album. This is called Focus.
Tethered to the cure, I focus on the pain. Transformation comes, tempered by the flame. And if this flesh should fail, devour me from within. May then my soul prevail, free to roam again.
Do you mind if I ask what it feels like to hear his voice even today?
It depends on the moment. Sometimes it's incredibly comforting. Other times I can't quite deal with it. Depends on the song, too. Something about this song doesn't destroy me the way others do. I think because I remember when it was written, you know, we were certainly dealing with it then, but it didn't feel dire yet.
It's so clear how not only the two of you sort of work together, but obviously how intimately you know each other.
Of course.
But because of that, were there times that he would be working away and being so focused on the music that you, knowing that he was ill, kind of wanted to knock on the door and be like, hey,
absolutely,
take a break.
Absolutely. I remember actually teasing him because there were definitely times where, you know, especially with the drums, because it's an incredible workout and he was incredibly weak at that point. And I was like, babe, you don't have to be killing yourself getting these demos pristine. We're going to re-record them again. You know, like, take a break, you know, eat some food. And it's, you know, it's one of those crazy things now. It's like, thank God that he actually did that, because now I have these recordings that are as close to perfect as they can possibly be. And now I have a record that I can put out.
Even the walls are shaking her down and breaking her mind with unsettling sounds. Courage collapses in uncertainty rings. She tries to summon the strength to thunder through it again.
Why is it called Axis Mundi, actually?
So I found that phrase written in his book of lyrics without any context, and I looked it up, and it's this mythical point where heaven and earth connect, and it opens up communication between higher and lower realms. And reading about this phrase was just, it was like a bolt of lightning hit me. I don't know what his intention was with that phrase, but to me it was obvious that it was meant for this record.
Well, let's listen to another song from Axis Mundi. This is Avalon.
You're a peach when proliferating portions of love, when the universe so seemingly storms from above. You're a huntress and a healer and a holder of hands, and your heart is the Avalon that I seek for my end.
Can you tell us about it?
Avalon is the only song on the record that is not credited. It's not listed on the track listing. And it's the only song that Dave didn't intend to be on the record. Avalon was written for me as a Christmas gift while he was ill. And it's funny that you just asked me what it's like to hear his voice, you know, and that one should be one that I can't handle. Mm-hmm. But instead, it's a huge source of strength. And one of the things that I'm pulling strength from is that line where he says, you're a healer and a huntress and a holder of hands. My new writing project is called The Huntress because of that. And, you know, it's because of him that I feel that I can even continue writing at all. And it felt like the perfect way to leave the record off as, like, this is how we felt about each other. This was our band. And now I'm the Huntress and I'm going to continue in his name.
Morgan Eve, thanks so much for coming in and
absolutely
for talking about the music and talking about Dave as well.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Morgan Eve Swain is one half of the band Brown Bird. her husband and musical partner Dave Lamb died in 2014. Their final album is called Axis Mundi. That's it for this special Thanksgiving Day edition of Radio Boston. I am utterly grateful for the dedication and spirit of our team, producers Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Buzek. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. And as always, I am grateful to you for listening to us day in and day out, for keeping us honest and keeping us strong. And I very much hope that you feel the glow of our gratitude on this day as well. Thank you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.